Bum bum bottom, 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 bum bum
You are now in session with the Comic Book Couples Counseling Podcast. I'm Lisa Gullickson.
And I'm Brad Gullickson.
And each month we evaluate a different iconic romance within the Four Color Realm. And in this episode, when's the last time we even saw grass? Do you remember grass? I remember grass. I do. Grass, grass, grass. So green. Maybe we should settle down in our creator corner. We're talking to Pornsack Pitchashote and Jesse Lonergan about Man's Best from Boom Studios.
Lisa, I want to start this episode with a public service announcement.
Okay.
Our listeners of our Patreon feed already know this.
Oh, yeah.
But I made a Zoom discovery, and I need everyone else who does podcasting out there that listens to this episode to know this now so you don't make the mistake that I did.
Brad is being a hero right now.
But if you listen to our recent Creator Cranny conversation with Oni publisher Hunter Goranson and the editor-in-chief Sierra Hahn, you will hear a very different Brad Gullickson.
A parallel universe, perhaps.
So that's one of the most chaotic interviews I've ever done, because I did it in the car while I was being chauffeured to Lisa, because Lisa had a horrendous migraine that day.
And yet I thought I could still work.
And so I'm driving Lisa around, and then this interview is happening. So part of the interview happens when I'm in the car waiting for Lisa in between her lessons, and also when I am driving Lisa from lesson to lesson.
Yeah.
And Hunter and Sierra knew this, and they were like, hey, we can reschedule, no big deal. They were very kind. They were willing to be flexible, but I was not. I was stubborn. I was like, no, your time is valuable. My time is valuable.
Sure.
I'm ready to talk Tales from the Crypt, EC Comics, and the partnership with Oni Press. Now let's do this. And we did it. I did not have, you know, the podcast set up with me in the car. I just had my iPhone. So in recording the Zoom with my iPhone, without a microphone, without a headset attached, I discovered that the noise suppression effect that Zoom offers, when you don't have those things attached to your phone, it creates a lisp for certain speakers. So if you go and listen to our episode with Hunter Goranson and Sierra Hahn, you will hear this, Brad. Hey, how's it going today? I want to talk about Vault of Horror and Tales from the Crypt. And not only do I not sound like myself to me, apparently I don't sound like myself to them, except they never say anything, because this is basically a filter that occurs when you record this way. And Lisa went online and started researching, like, is this an actual issue? And yes, it is an issue. And you can read these horror stories where people are in Zoom meetings and their business partners are like, are you okay? Are you having a stroke?
Yeah.
And one woman actually went to the emergency room and spent thousands of dollars there getting tested before she learned that this filter situation can occur.
And, like, I mean, maybe people who have more facility with, audio can understand why this kind of thing can happen. But, like, to us, it was like an SNL sketch. It was, like, completely, like, bizarre. And to me, it's like the audio equivalent of, like, when somebody goes on the news and then they discover that their five-year-old had put a cat filter on the Zoom and they have to do the entire interview that way because they don't know how to turn the filter off. Like, we had done that. And, like, I feel like when you create audio content, there is, like, this thing of where you have to get used to the sound of your voice, because our voice, the way we hear it in our heads, is different than what gets picked up in audio because of bone conduction. Then all of a sudden, when you hear a recording of yourself that doesn't sound like you, it's like as if you looked in a mirror And then all of a sudden you're like, that's not my face. You know, it's just crazy.
I'm sure there are now classes all across America on podcasting, but many of us are learning on the fly, mm-hmm. right? Lisa and I never took any classes. And I think this is why it's important when you do encounter something like that, that you do go to the online community, that you do go to your podcasting friends and say, hey, this is occurring. Has this ever happened to you? Can you think of any solutions for us?
Brad and I often celebrate how small the comics community is, and the comics podcasting community is even smaller than that. So it really is up to us to be looking out for each other.
Yeah, that's so true. And recently, David Harper, the person behind Sketched and the co-host of the Off-Panel podcast, reached out to us to discuss this connection that comics and podcasting seems to have.
And we were so incredibly flattered that David Harper would reach out to us about our thoughts, because in our small little pond, we see David Harper as a big fish. Oh, we've been fans for a long time.
Yeah, yeah. You know, like, we all have our comic book celebrity crushes, people like Grant Morrison and Dwayne McDuffie, the Simonsons, Trina Robbins, right? But the more you read comics and the more you obsess over comics, you then start to fall in love with the comic book advocates.
Mm-hmm.
And we think of David Harper as one of the great comic book advocates.
Yes.
Heidi McDonald yes. would be another one.
Zach Quaintance,
our last guest, would be another one.
These people are the movers and the shakers.
John Suntress,
yes.
right?
Yes, yes.
And so for David Harper to come to us and want to talk to us about the connection of comic books and podcasting, like, that was huge.
A thrill.
And he's put together a really cool article on Sketched, link in the show notes, with us involved, but John Suntress as well, the Oblivion Bar Boys, Matthew Rosenberg, our buddy Botter from the Short Box podcast. And yeah, it's a great read. And if you're at all interested in comic book podcasting, and you must be because you're listening to us, go click on the link and give this article a read.
And even if you're not interested in starting a podcast, I think if you're interested in starting something, I think that this is a good read. Because sometimes, especially when you haven't started your thing yet, and you're looking at all of the people that you admire that are doing the thing that you want to do, it can feel like intimidating to just get started, because you think that you are competing with those other people that you love so much. And the fact of the matter is, and I, as a selfish person, really had to come to grips with this, that when you're in the arts, you're not actually competing with anybody else
yeah.
because you're the only you that there is.
Yeah.
And a rising tide raises all ships.
Yeah, that was a tough lesson to learn, especially for Lisa. You
yeah.
were a little resistant early on in partnering with people, right?
Yeah, yeah. I don't know why, because I'm like, well, they're going to discover that this other person is better than me and then drop me altogether.
But the moment, Lisa, you decided to, like, no, we should partner more often. We should reach out. We should help others as much as we can. We discovered
that, sound like it, a monster.
That it helps us.
Yeah.
I'm included there too. You know,
yeah.
like
it's easy to get really precious.
It's easy to get precious, and it's easy to fall into the trap of, like, I gotta protect my thing.
Right.
Right. I'm all about us. I gotta uplift us. Right. And that's a mistake. That's a huge mistake.
Right.
And so if you are out there listening and you are a new podcast or an old podcast and you've been doing this for decades and you need some reviews, just reach out to Brad and
yeah,
Lisa.
Yeah, we'll give you five stars.
We'll give you five
for
stars.
Free.
Yeah, absolutely.
And if you ever, we've had people reach out to us for advice
yeah,
and tips and
yeah,
all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And we are incredibly open to
you
that.
Know,
so please slip into our DMs. Open with a little flattery. Tell us how great you think we are. And then we'll tell you how to do your thing.
We're all in this together.
Yeah.
And we have to look out for each other.
100%.
Just like the stars, get ready for this transition, Lisa.
Ooh.
Just like the stars of this week's book, Man's Best, they have to look out for each other.
Yeah, when you say transition, I always think about Star Wars and, like, those swipes.
Swipes. This is one of those star swipes.
Yeah.
That's how grand this transition is. Last year, when we were putting together our most anticipated comics of 2024, Man's Best was one of the first ones we were like, this is on the list. Because it is a collaboration between one of our favorite artists, Jesse Lonergan, past Comic Book Couples Counseling guest. We talked to him about Miss Truesdale and the Fall of Hyperborea. And Porn Sack Pitchashote, the writer behind one of our favorite comics of recent memory, The Good Asian. And when you hear that these two are going to collaborate, it's not an obvious match. Their styles don't immediately align in your imagination. But with that clash comes a tension, and that tension is what's so damn compelling about the idea of them collaborating. And then you actually read Man's Best, and it's everything you wanted and more.
And it ends up feeling like the most natural thing ever. But you'll hear in this interview, when you are in a partnership, it is up to you to change what you do slightly to meet your partner where they're at. And isn't that the most comic book couples counseling thing you've ever heard in your life?
The first issue of Man's Best is out now from Boom Studios, and it's about three emotional support animals living on a space station that's traveling the universe in search of a new Earth, a new home for us humans. Two dogs, one cat, they are Athos, Porthos, and Lovey.
Mm-hmm.
Half of the first issue is about introducing their roles on this ship and their relationships, and the other half is after a disaster strikes and they are abandoned on a mysterious world that is populated seemingly by these robotic clangers.
Just a heads up, this is a full spoilers interview about the first issue. So if you are sensitive to that kind of thing, you can go on Omnibus or you can go to your comic book store and get the first issue, read it up, nom nom nom, read that comic, and then listen to this interview. If you're a person who does not fear spoilers, then just keep listening. I don't know why I said that. You know that. You do you, is what I'm saying.
Lisa and I just love anthropomorphic stories,
mm-hmm.
and Man's Best is, pardon the pun, catnip for us.
I love that. I don't know. I'm a child.
You know, think about comics like We Three
yeah.
from Grant Morrison and Frank Quitely, or Primordial from Jeff Lemire and Andrea Sorrentino. Yeah, so if you dig those books, you're going to dig Man's Best. And hopefully for the animals of Man's Best, works out a little bit better than it did for the animals of We Three. But we don't know.
We don't know.
We've only read the first issue. In this interview, I do think that there are hints that things are going to get pretty harrowing for Porthos, Athos, and Lovey. And we do talk about the value of putting animals in danger and making animals your protagonists. That's, you know, really what I wanted to get to with our conversation with Jesse and Pornsack, and we get to it pretty darn quickly at the start of the chat. But before we bring them into the love nest for this conversation, Lisa, we need to do some
referrals.
Sponsored by Omnibus. Omnibus is a modern digital comic book store and reader app carrying your favorite single issues, volumes, and omnibuses all day and date. Just like your local comic book store, you pay per book, but digital.
Their focus is on building an excellent customer shopping and reading experience and using novel discovery features to help fans find their next new favorite book. They feature top-tier content and already have many of the top publishers in comics today.
And starting today, they've just added Massive to their roster.
Pew, pew, pew.
So Zorro, Man of the Dead, you can now read on Omnibus. In the spirit of helping people find their next new favorite book, we have our referrals segment. The idea is to give our counselees, that's you guys, further reading on the themes of the episode. Think of it as us sending you to specialists to further your healing journey through comic books.
Obviously, the correct answer to this referral is Primordial, which is on Omnibus and has already been mentioned in this episode and has actually already been a referral of mine, so I had to go another direction, but I am super in love with my pick. It is The Cat from the Kimono by Nancy Pena from Humanoids. This story is part fairy tale, part literary figure fan fiction, but it starts with this woman who has this beautiful kimono with cats printed on it, and the jealous weaver who loved her. But through magical circumstances, one of the cats comes to life and runs off, getting lost, and we follow the fabric cat's journey back to the kimono. And Sherlock Holmes is there, and Alice in Wonderland is there. Okay. The circumstances are kind of trippy and fantastical, but the art is beautiful and available on Omnibus.
Yeah, have not read this myself, but looking over your shoulder, that art is beautiful, and I'm going to have to check it out.
Yeah.
So, I stuck with an animal theme as well.
Oh, it's not just an animal theme. It's the idea that when we see an animal, we don't know their intentions, and we supersede their intentions with our human ideas of what a cat wants. I didn't say that, but that's how it relates.
Gotcha. All right. Okay. Well, I'm just going.
It's not just because it has a cat in it.
Well, I'm just going with a comic that has a cat in it.
Perfect. Okay?
Stray Dogs is one of my favorite Image comic series of recent memory, but I'm not recommending that, even though you can also get that on Omnibus. I'm recommending that creative team's follow-up. The creative team being writer Tony Fleece and artist Trish Forstner. And they have a new series, a new number one called Feral. And it follows three indoor cats, Elsie, Lord Fluffy, Britches, and Patch. And they are lost in the woods, Lisa, and they want to get home. You know, it's a homeward bound situation. There's only one added element. There is a massive rabies outbreak.
Yikes.
And all these rabid animals are attacking them, are chasing them, are hunting them through the woods.
So it's like a zombie thing?
It's a zombie comic.
How fun.
With rabies. So yeah, take like Stray Cat, add David Cronenberg's Rabid to it, and you get Feral. The art, like with Stray Dogs, is incredible. I love the characterization of the three indoor cats. And I love the fear and terror that they experience in this first issue. Tonally, it's very different than Man's Best, but I think it also raises questions of why we choose to use animals as protagonists. Mm. And it is available on Omnibus.
Omnibus is available as an app for iPhone, iPad, and it's in beta form on Android, but you don't need those things to read and buy books on Omnibus. All you need is a browser. If you've got a browser, you've got a comic book store.
Lisa and I have been really taking advantage of the wish list.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of like building your shopping cart or your pull box and then just waiting to hit the trigger on the purchase when the funds become available.
Yeah.
And on that note, Lisa, I think that brings us to the conclusion of
referrals.
So let's go ahead and bring Jesse and Pornsack into the love nest. Again, Man's Best number one is currently available from Boom Studios, and issue two will be hitting stands and digital comic book stores everywhere on April 24th.
For sensitive ears, there is some swearing in this interview, and most of it is coming from me. There is one point where I just don't have a better word than the swear word, and then for some reason, it just pulled the plug on my filthy mouth, so I apologize.
I was going to put our little woo sensor on all your profanity, but should I leave it with no woos?
I don't know. You can surprise me.
Okay.
But I am embarrassed.
I think it's funny that you're bringing it up.
I don't know.
It's not that bad.
We're all adults here, but maybe you're listening and you've got like a person in the car seat in the back.
Honestly, I don't think this warning is necessary.
Okay.
I'm going to take care of it, I think. But, you know, if you feel like the woo sensor that we use gets in the way of the information that you're trying to communicate, I won't use it.
Okay. Well, I think probably for the first one, you shouldn't.
Okay.
But all of the following ones were completely, they're just unnecessary salt.
You're so funny.
I know.
Anyway, here is Jesse and Pornsack talking about Man's Best number one. Jesse and Pornsack, welcome to Comic Book Couples Counseling. Hello.
Hey, how's it going?
Hey, how you doing?
We're doing great because you're here talking about Man's Best.
We're so excited to get into this story. I know that it is very personal for you, but I wanted to start with the idea of animals, because I feel like I've been on a journey with animals that started entirely with the internet, where you're like, oh my God, this goat and this cat are actually best friends. Or like, look at all of these turtles help flip one of them over. They really do care. You know, like, can you talk about a little bit of your journey of understanding with animals, and if you have particular animals that have inspired you, like those dogs who talk with buttons? I'm obsessed.
Oh my God. The funny thing is working on this book too, like, 'cause you know, I think I told people about 2 years, 3 years ago about this book. And when that happens, then everyone sends you memes about animals. So I've seen so many like dog playing on an Xbox controller, or like dog trying to drive a car. And like I've gotten all of them. So yeah, for me, it's hard to say where it started. I think I had pets growing up. I had two dogs growing up, and now I'm kind of like the resident pet sitter amongst friends. So I get like a cat here or a dog there, and all that kind of stuff. And it's always, I don't never know if I should be vaguely insulted by like people always being shocked with me having like you're like cat sitting for a week. I'm like, what kind of monster can't look after a cat for a week? Like, why is it so shocking that like me just being around like another animal? And but yeah, so I just have sort of a lot of pets around, and anything specifically in my building. During the my pet my building used to be a pet free zone, like you couldn't have animals in it. But then over the pandemic, they allowed cats as emotional support animals. So now there are tons of cats like in the building, and all that kind of stuff. And that is absolutely when I started thinking about like pets as emotional support animals, because it's this new thing that happened in my building.
I don't think I didn't have the same journey. I think I mostly grew up in the country, and you know, like with like farm cows, like right across the fence from my like backyard. And so I feel like I always had dogs growing up, like for the entirety. And I just feel though, like if you grow up in the country, you know, there's a little bit of a rougher relationship with animals. Of like, there are animals that are dangerous, like that will, you know, get into your backyard or you know, try and sneak into the house, like mice and stuff like that. But they're also kind of just sort of ever present. So I don't know that I had that same sort of like, I don't know. They're like an ever-present thing, I feel.
I grew up with a very like suburban idea of pets and animals, and I never had a dog, and I have
Okay.
always wanted one so terribly. I've always wanted one. He won't let me have one.
Oh.
It's my last childhood dream that's kind of still alive.
We'll have one eventually.
But
What's the reasoning
yeah,
for not
what?
having one?
I grew up with one dog, and I
I
had a
have
dog
bad
all the way through
relationship.
my childhood to when I got to college and she finally
Okay.
passed away, poor Bridget.
Yeah.
And that death was so
Yeah.
traumatic, and it was long. It was like a long year.
Yeah.
It was a year-long process, and I've committed to another being, and I know that there's possibly sadness unless I go first, which is my plan in
Oh,
my
yeah, go first.
in my future. So the idea of like getting another animal in our life that's gonna perish before us, I was like, I don't know, I don't know.
I actually totally agree with that. I sort of had like co-ownership sort of like with the dog, with an ex of mine. And when the dog passed, it gutted me so much. I'm like, I can never go through this again. I don't have the strength to deal with it. So I totally get where you're coming from on that.
Having had a lot of dogs, there's a lot of like pain at the end.
Yeah.
I don't think it's enough. I don't think it's enough to say don't get the dog. I feel the rewards are there too.
Well, we got a snake.
We do have a snake.
I'm
Snakes live
a
a very long time.
I have a turtle currently,
Aww.
and this turtle is 38. You know, so it's older than a lot of people I know.
My snake is not like cuddly though. Like she's
Neither is
middle
the turtle.
aged and angry. So I want to go to one of the themes of the book and the idea of like we see in animals our best, that we presume sincerity, loyalty, and innocence. And I feel like if we could figure out a way to have that like same compassion for like human beings, where I feel like we see an asshole on the street and we go like that's a bad person, like that's not a good person, and then we see a dog being an asshole and we go like somebody ruined that dog, what has
Yeah,
that
it's so
dog gone
true.
through?
That is so
Like,
true.
is that something that's front of mind? Do you really believe that animals are as innocent as we presume?
I do. I I do personally. I think a lot. So much of this came sort of from the pandemic. I mentioned how like the building had sort of a cat. I had so many. You know, there was that whole thing about like there were no dogs to get at shelters and to get at shelters anymore. So everybody sort of got them. I do think it's just sort of like they are sort of the belief that they are simple. Their needs sort of seem to be simpler. They don't have the same ambitions that we do. It does not seem. Now cats could go either way. But like mm-hmm. dogs, it feels like they don't have the same ambitions. Their ambitions are much simpler. And so it feels like, I don't know. So I feel like there is a piece of that that is just sort of like all our best qualities. I also think too, we have a tendency to project onto pets whatever we want to project. And most mm-hmm. of the time, it is like the most simplest, purest sort of things. And so I do think there's something about pets where you get to sort of see like purity kind of like, you know, just sort of roam around.
Yeah, I feel they are more innocent in that it is like a simpler thing. Like I think of like when you say an asshole, I'm like, oh, like the people who berate waiters
or wait
staff, like that kind of person. And a dog is never going to berate any like this extended diatribe against some person they don't know. Like they're going to get angry, express their anger, and move along. And like there's sort of that purity of an animal that humans, we get more complicated and we get to the point where someone's yelling at a stranger for no really, other than their past trauma, that we should be giving them the benefit of the doubt.
but also pets aren't like petty the way humans are. Mm-hmm. So yeah. Like, I feel like, you know, like when a pet is petty, you can usually, it's very easy to trace it back to why that pet is being petty. Like humans are being petty, and you could spend years in your life trying to figure out like where that came from.
And so with Man's Best, you know, one of the delights of the book is how the two species cannot actually communicate. Like they, you know, Doc Winters has an idea of what's going on with her support animals. And then they have an idea of what's going on, but there is that divide. And so I'm curious about why you insisted on having that divide, and then how do you manage that divide?
Well, I think for me, it's, you know, I for me, it's kind of like the Secret Life of Pets rules, where it's just like they've got this completely different, like, you know, idea of sort of what is happening. And then, but also too, like, you know, a big like inspiration for the Met suits specifically is like, and me and Jesse talk about this a lot, those internet videos you see of like dogs running around in UPS costumes or like in serial killer costumes. There is no way that dog has any idea that like, oh, here my owner wants me to look like Mike Myers. It is so adorable to my owner that I look like Mike Myers. Yeah, yeah, exactly, exactly. They have no context for any of that sort of stuff. So like, they like, what the heck is going through that dog's head? Where it's like, it can't, like, even, I think about this all the time, like, people love dressing up their dogs in like cute outfits. Like, is it comfortable for them? Like, do they even like that? Like, you know, it's just it, and it can't possibly be one to one. It can't possibly, like, when you give a dog a bath, like, it can't possibly, like, they must think you're torturing them in some way, at least for a little while, right? So there's no way they see like eye to eye sort of with what they see. So then it was just sort of the fun of taking things that we know as readers and sort of seeing like, what does it look like from sort of like that, a completely different perspective, and like, what's their interpretation of things. And that's one of the reasons why at the start of the book, you're going to see sort of a lot of like familiar sort of sci-fi things like spaceships and robots and all that sort of stuff. And as we go, things will get sort of wilder and wilder. But I think in the beginning, we just wanted to center around familiar things, because it's just fun to have their perspective on things that we see all the time. And you don't often get to see, you know, a dog's perspective on a giant robot. And so, and then as we go and things get wilder, and as things get wilder, that's where I get really excited for everything that Jesse does, because like Jesse does all this amazing sort of stuff. Like issue 3 is just takes us in a whole new realm, and I'm super excited for what Jesse's doing there. But I think that for me, that's where it comes. It's just like, I can't believe a dog thinks what we do when it's wearing a UPS outfit. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I also think it's sort of good, like a good decision on like porn sex part, and like narratively of like, in this first issue, there are people But then I don't draw people again. Like, you know, like issue two, there are no people. Like, you know, and sort of like, you know, it does this job of establishing the pets are their own thing. Like they're not lockstep. And so like it sort of sets you up for the adventure that they're gonna go on as sort of like independent creatures.
Hornsack, you've talked about like this is a very vulnerable book release for you, and that this book is a very you're approaching a very different tone, and you've spoken very specifically about who your audience is for this book. You keep saying like, I wrote it for adults, but I wanted it to be accessible for all. And talking to a lot of like comic book creators who end up writing YA, a lot of it is like the, oh my goodness, I've walked backwards into I'm writing all ages stuff.
Right.
And I just want you to talk a little bit about like your journey into all ages and why, how this story is for adults versus
It's,
everyone.
yeah, I think it's it for me, it's so weird because like I want it to be for all for everyone, and yet at the same time, whenever I hear it's just like, oh, it's a for all ages. I'm like, is it? I'm is it like I am I writing for all ages? Like I think for me, it's like I'm always writing for adults. I'm always writing for like peers and fellow people sort of in that 20, 10, 20, 30 years sort of like age range of all that. So I think the extra challenge here was making it such a way that I wasn't putting off younger readers. And I guess for me what that means is because like I, you know, so much of what I, you know, what I've written in the past, most everything else I've written, it's like horror. It's a little bit edgier and all that kind of stuff. And there's sex in it. And I think the germ of this idea happened my very first free comic book day, where kids would come to the table and be like, oh no, get away. Get away. I don't want to be responsible for this. Go. And then it'd be like, it would be great to do a book where I don't have to like physically restrain a child from getting close, because I don't want to deal with the repercussions from their parents. And so I think it was more less me thinking like, how do I write something for everybody? And more, I guess, me writing what I normally write, but I don't have to shield children away from it. And I think that was more the mentality sort of I took. 'Cause yeah, because I don't, you know, it's funny when you say stuff like all ages or YA, like in my brain, and maybe I'm completely wrong, and maybe this is why I don't write that stuff, because I should have a better perspective on it. I always think you're writing directly for that audience, and I don't know how Pixar movies are written, like, but in my brain it's like, are they writing directly for children but making it so it's accessible for adults, or they're making another layer that adults can understand? But that's not how I'm doing it. I'm writing for adults. I'm just trying at every point being kind of like, is there anything here that you would need to protect a child from and a younger reader from? And even and having said that, there are parts of the book where it's just like, oh, you might want to read those two issues back to back, or you might want to, like, you know, like I don't know, I don't know if, you know, you know, you might want to read it first at the very least. I think by the time you get to the end of the book you'll be fine, but like it might get a little harrowing at points. But it's mostly for me just I'm still writing the way I write, but not but not basically not trying to shield other people from it. And I think because of that, I wonder, it's like, ooh, are all my tricks for adults? Like, once I take all that stuff away, is there anything left for people to enjoy?
And Jesse, does age at all come into play when you're working on Man's Best versus any other previous book of yours?
Not really. I think my style is actually pretty all ages. Like it leans a bit cartoony, you know, in comparison to other stuff. And I think in terms of like what Pornchak said, like, you know, it's not like I'm drawing anything that I have to worry about. And I sort of feel like with Man's Best, it was sort of this like opportunity to express a side that I hadn't necessarily done before, and sort of this like much more like what I post on Instagram, which is like kind of like, I think it's okay for everybody. Like, I guess people might think it's gross, but like it's like a juvenile gross. It's not like an
Kids love
adult.
gross.
Yeah, like it's like the kind of gross like like boogers are gross and like the Garbage Pail Kids were gross, but it's that kind of gross. And so like I feel like this was sort of like kind of something where I could just sort of do what I wanted and I didn't really have to worry about that. But I also feel like, I don't know, I feel like I'm kind of a prude anyway, so it's not like I'm drawing like lots of sex or violence normally. I feel like I'm known for this like wordless comic about a spaceship flying through
Right.
space. So I didn't really feel like I had to worry. There are the scenes that Pornsak mentioned that it felt like it had to be done delicately, because it is an action story, and so with action there's physical danger to dogs, I feel like has to be handled carefully.
Yeah.
Or any pet, just like that. It's like in a movie, like 50 people get shot, and I'm like, no problem. It's like they shot a dog. Like,
Yeah.
this movie's awful. I can't accept it. That sort of conflict. But like, so there are sections like that where I felt like it had to be handled delicately. But other than that, I felt kind of at ease.
Yeah, it's interesting that you mention, violence towards dogs versus violence towards humans. We're part of a film club in Winchester, Virginia, and they love horror. They love, Evil Dead. Let's see some people get just totally obliterated. But the moment a dog or yeah, it's really dogs. They're real dog people. The moment a dog is injured or killed, they want to burn the theater down. Like, it's so intense.
If you think of the scenes in Evil Dead, if I saw that being done to a dog, I would be like, I cannot watch this movie. Like I would walk out of the theater, but with Evil Dead, I'm like, oh, this is cool.
I think that speaks to what we were discussing earlier, like how we observe animals versus how we observe ourselves and what we want out of animals versus what we want out of ourselves.
I personally find it like really concerning, like when people are like, yeah, let's watch Raid 2, you know what I mean? And then a dog gets injured and people are devastated. And I go like, oh my goodness, people are animals, right? We're all just walking, we're just walking meat puppets. Like, I don't know. I say bring on the dog death.
Lisa wouldn't make the Evil Dead of canine films. Just
The tree scene is upsetting because dogs love trees so much. Maybe they'd be into it. I don't know. This got weird. You can edit
I'm not
No.
going to. We're gonna keep that. But I will get us back to the
Please
conversation.
do.
The other thing, Jesse, is I feel like looking at your what you post on Instagram and looking at like the designs that end up on t-shirts that
On
you
our t-shirts,
on
like
our
it's our entire con wardrobe is Jesse Lonergan stuff.
And I look at those designs and I feel like you have been building towards this design aesthetic that is really showcased through the mech suits in Man's Best. Like, is this a release? And was it? I can't imagine that it was strategy to get to this point, or is it kind of like, oh, this is the perfect
No,
comic to pursue the thing I've been doing?
it's like I don't know. It's sort of I feel one of possibly the good and the blessings or curses of my personality is like I'm always sort of like trying to figure out like something else, and so it's like, oh, I like working in this style, but it's like I also want to push this sort of weird cartoony chibi style stuff. And so I never really get great at anything. But like it was something I've been working on, and like it wasn't something that like I had like a story for. And then like Eric Harburn at Boone approached me with this story, and it felt just like a perfect fit. Like I was like, yeah, that's I totally want to do that. And it just, it clicked.
Yeah, I mean, Eric really deserves Eric Harburn over at Boom really deserves our all the credit. Like he was the one, because I when I this pitch got to Boom, I was just like, I think I told this story before, but like in my mind, usually when I'm making a book, I distinctly see the art style sort of as I'm making it. And when I was originally making this book, it looked like Stray Dogs. It looked like that sort of that Don Bluth sort of style. And then Stray Dogs came out, and I'm like, oh shoot, they did it, and I'm not going to do it as well as that. So like, I have no idea what this looks like now. And so when it got to Eric, he was, and I was like, I'm going to be no help here because like I'm tripped up in my old way of thinking and all that sort of stuff. And so he was a fresh eyes, and he kind of came on board and being like, listen, you know, Jesse does all this cute animal stuff on his Instagram. He does all this crazy sci-fi stuff on his comics, but he's never done his comics with the stuff on his Instagram. This could be the perfect like time. And I was just like, oh my God, that's an amazing idea. I've talked about this a lot. I never thought Jesse would work with me. Not that Jesse's difficult or anything like that. I just thought when you make comics like Hydra and Planet Paradise, like, why do you want to work with another writer? You could just keep doing that. So I'm like, no, there's no way Jesse wants to work with a writer. But Eric had the foresight to think like, no, I think he does. I think he's looking at other things and all that kind of stuff. And that's how that happened.
You mentioned in the back matter of the book that like you took the opportunity to change the way that you wrote to accommodate Jesse's creativity. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, it's actually one of my favorite things to talk about because it's so geeky. It is so basically an average issue of Man's Best has about half the amount of words that my comics usually have, with the exception of two. They're always two pages which have more than half the amount of words that my comics usually have. And that's because, and it's one thing I noticed about sort of Jesse when he was working with other writers, and when I was talking with Jesse sort of as well, this kind of like more fruit, where it's just like one of the things I noticed is that if you put too many words on there, and I think Jesse sort of says best, when you put too many words on there, the words, the comic page is more about the words than it is about the art, and the art is almost supplementing the words. And I definitely noticed that like, oh, the best way to get everything that Jesse can play is like giving the art sort of more room to sort of breathe. And so the way I work for this is that it's very, very interesting. I find it very, very interesting. I don't know if anyone else does, but I find it very, very interesting where I take my usual, like I might think about the page the way I normally think about a page. And then what I do is I like abstract myself from the process as much as possible. So like so every page, it has five panels. When the script goes to Jesse, every page has five panels. Every action sequence has four panels. And then if I had the desire to put more, I like start pulling it back. I pull it back. So the idea is that it is to, in a weird way, to, and it'll always be there because it's me, but it's to strip away as much of my story instincts as possible to get to the pure story. So that when Jesse gets it, he can sort of apply sort of his story instincts and break all that action up however he likes. But yeah, so you'll see panel pages on this book that will have 20 panels on a page or 13. They all start from a five panel page that I give Jesse and basically tell him do whatever you want. And part of doing that means like, okay, I have to have less words on a page. And so every issue there are two pages in that issue where there are more than my usual half the words that I usually do on a page. But to balance that, every issue, there's at least two pages where the descriptions is just like three or four lines. And I'm just like, Jesse, break it up however you want. Like, this is the action that's sort of happening there. And so it's been really wild to kind of work that way and to see what Jesse comes back with and all that stuff. So yeah, so it's super fun. Yeah, and I'm sure there's other ways I'm thinking about that. I've changed, but yeah, not to completely take over the conversation with like all the different ways I write for Jesse, which I find amazing.
Do other artists just draw however many panels they're told to draw?
What's that?
Is that how it works?
however you do it. Yeah.
Okay.
Did you know you were know. Being? Did you know or did you feel you were being accommodated? Did he tell you like what's porn talk? Like I'm changing it. Yeah. This is for you specifically.
Yeah. We talked about it. And it's like, you know, some of the stuff is what he said. When it's text heavy, that's going to like guide the page, you know, like that's going to define how it is. If there's a lot of like dialogue back and forth, that really like that defines how the eye is going to move across a page and stuff like that. And so like the less text there is, like the easier it is to do sort of, I mean, it's obvious. I feel like, you know, like there's no words. It's like, oh, the artist can draw whatever they want. And so I was aware, like, I mean, he keeps track of like word count. What was your word count for Good Asians?
My word count for Good Asian is I never go more than 210 words a page, and then right. And that was based on an Alan Moore thing. So Alan Moore has this thing which I think he got from Mort Weisinger of 210 words a page is the most like copy you can have and like still sort of balance sort of everything. And how you figure out how many words should go with a panel is you divide it. So like, and because I've done this so much, I know the math. Like on a 9-panel page, if you're doing 210 words a page, there shouldn't be more than 23 words a panel. And it's one of the reasons why I use Word, because I'm constantly checking what my word count is. And then the art comes in and you sort of adjust it accordingly. But then, but it gives you sort of a loose guide. And then I think Neil Gaiman took that, and this can't be early issues of Sandman, so it must be what he's writing now, where it's 100, he does 180 words a page. And so when I was doing Dead Boy Detectives, because it's in the Sandman universe, in homage to Neil, there were no more than 180 words a page in there. But working with Jesse, there's no more than 100 words a page, except for two pages where there's no more than 180. But I actually feel like most of those pages, we don't go up to even like 150. But yeah, I keep like religious count of all the words, you know, that on in each panel, in each page. And then, but then like, even when you'll do that, you'll still get like, you know, especially newer artists, you'll do that and they'll still like, the image will be the dead center. And you're like, oh, but I, what do I, yeah. I don't have any place to put this.
Right. No, I also write out all those words. Like on the page, like,
oh, that's cool.
Oh yeah, it's all like written out by hand, and so like I'm like that, so that the letter Jeff Powell, like I'm like, he should have enough space, because I did it by hand, not like super deep, like really like scribbly, but like that's that text area, and then just sort of figuring out like, I don't know, how to play with the space on the page to sort of, I don't know, get the most out of it and get like a balance.
If somebody came to you and was like, I've noticed there's only 100 words per page, would you just like shit a brick? Would you be like so satisfied that somebody noticed that, that the math specifically?
I would be amazed. Like, the really funny thing is like, I've been working with this 210 sort of scope for so long, is that whenever I see a comics page, I'm like, wow, that's kind of dense, because now I will count words on comics pages, is what I will do out of just for fun. And and whenever I do, I'm like, oh yeah, oh, more than 210 words, more than 210 words, like, and it might just be my sort of aesthetic, but anytime now, like, I can tell if there's a dense comic page and it's just like, oh, there's a lot of words on there, it will all, I will, once I do the counting, it will always be more than 210 words.
I feel, to me, maybe this is just what I read, 210 sounds really high for like a modern comic book page. For like Alan Moore, like Watchmen, you know, 1980s, that sound, or like, and if you go back to like Marvel, like Marvel in the 60s, like, okay,
I've got
300
from hell right here. I'm
oh,
like,
there you go.
Is
yeah. We never go more than arm's length from hell. It just helps us feel safe.
Nice.
But I feel modern must be lower. It must be lower than
I
that.
Think modern, I was, especially like the image era of comics too, is they're much, I think the image era of comics is much less. Like, I know Mark Waid, again, I spend way too much time paying attention to this stuff and thinking about anything, but Mark Waid has sort of said when he's doing a book, there's no more than 100 words, 100 words a page. And to me, if you're doing an action adventure, like Marvel DC comic, that feels about right. And then you just sort of shift into like sort of the denser, wordier kind of stuff. So it's very much like a genre-y thing, I think too. Like, yeah, I think Infidel, we did 210 words. The Good Asian made sense at 210 words, because that book, in the weirdest way possible, I wanted you to feel like you were reading an old pulp novel, even though you were reading a comic. And so that's a denser, that's a whole other conversation I can have, where like there's actually like 50% more story in Good Asian, because there was a conscious effort to have more be there. And it's primarily so you get this weird feeling, even though you're not reading a prose novel. I want you to feel like you're reading a prose novel, even though you're reading a comic. And part of that is by the density of the panels.
Before we get out of here, I'd like to get back to the thematic elements of Man's Best. And again, going to the little note at the back of the first issue, Pornsack, you're talking about how it is such a personal story and how it is about not necessarily surviving through crisis, but living through crisis, right?
Yeah.
Living through crisis. You know, what are you looking to get out of this creation process with Man's Best? And what do you hope people like us, readers like us, get out of it?
I mean, I hope you guys are entertained. I hope it gives you things to think about. I don't have, you know, listen, if people are entertained, I am happy when it comes to like what other people, what readers are sort of getting out of it. For me, this book was just a weird it's a weird process. And I give, again, our editor, Eric Harburn, all the credit for this, where I, primarily because I write in genre, I know writers who are what I consider confessional writers, where they, something happens in their life and like, I can't wait to put that in a script, or like, and, or they will do things, you know, just under the prompts of things they are writing just to like get star stuff in there. I am not one of those writers. Too many people die, too many people, like, you know, in my books, like horrible things happen to people, does not serve me well to be confessional in that way. That said though, in this particular book, like every issue, there is a scene where I'm just like, oh, I know where in my life this comes from. I know what in my life this is sort of speaking to. And I would say for all my books, there's that perspective at the heart of it, but I've never had it in like every scene of every issue. There's like, oh, this is from this life, this is from that life, this is from this. And so there is a weird thing that Tracy, and was not intentional, and I think part of it was just Eric pushing me to go deeper and deeper into the material, is that by the time you get to the end of the series, what the book is about and where the characters end up is very much something I believe, and I don't think I realize I believe that. And so when I look at this, when I look at each of the books, it's a weird thing of me being like, oh, I believe that because of these experiences in my life. And these four experiences in my life led me to sort of think that. That was not something I was intending to do when I sort of created. But it was very much, the idea was, and I think I mentioned it in the back matter, where the book really, you know, so much of the inspiration from the book came from sort of the quarantine and came from the pandemic. And this idea of living through crisis and how crisis affects friendships. And I'm someone who's had a good friendship affected by the pandemic. I know a lot of people who, you know, they're friends in the start of it and now they don't talk anymore, and for the range of reasons. And so I wanted to work that out sort of in the writing of it without really, I think when I started, I didn't really understood what that meant. And I get, it was Eric who sort of pushed me to go deeper into the material sort of at every stage, to the point I got aggravated with it at different portions, but he really pushed me to go deeper with it. And it's really fascinating now to kind of look at it where it's just like, oh, wow, it is, the book is very much about, you know, friendship through the crisis and how we, you know, how people can drift apart, or how we can look at things, how we can think we're on the same page when we're not on the same page about things. But then there's it took on its life of its own, where it's about sort of a perspective, I guess, on looking at the world and looking at relationships that I really do, by the end of it, I feel like, oh, wow, I really do believe that. And I don't think I knew that kind of going in. And it is weird. And I've had that before in other books, but I've never had the experience where it's just like, oh, wow, by going through this book, I can actually see the experiences in my life that led me to believe that. And that's something I've never had before. So the book is weirdly personal. It's a book about cats and dogs in space, but it's very oddly personal to me in a way I wasn't quite intending when I started off to write it.
Jesse, did you feel that on your end? Did you feel that you were receiving something that was precious in this specific way?
Yeah, like it's sort of funny. I don't know if it was going to make sense, but like tying into sort of the all ages thing. Mm-hmm. I would say the thing that makes it very much not all ages for me is like the moral sort of complexity that's sort of going on in it. And I feel like this is a little like a few too many shades of gray for like an all ages book. But I feel like I could feel that change and feel sort of the growth of it from like what it was sort of pitched as, you know, at the very beginning, which was much more like a romp. And it really, there's romp elements in it, but like it gets more into it, you know, and it gets deeper, as it goes on. And so, yeah, it was great seeing that growth of the story, as I was working on it.
I am so curious now because I've only read the first issue, obviously. So, yeah. And I do feel like that it being very like optimistic message forward, and now knowing that there are shades of gray ahead for me is like, oh man,
something harrowing.
Harrowing, yeah. Harrowing. I am so entirely like hooked.
Yeah, I'm guessing some animal violence. We should for our Winchester friends.
One of the scenes in this first issue that really stuck out to me was Doc lying on the bed and going like, I'm sad because I'm bad with people and the captain isn't noticing me. And the animals see that and go like, she's sad because of us. Like, we failed in the hollow chamber and we have disappointed her. And now she's expressing sadness out of like, where there's is this kind of like childlike myopicness where it's just like, clearly what's happening is because of us. And the theme of like, but it's like more generous than a child where it's just like, okay, well, we got to get to work because clearly she's disappointed in us. And, you know, we're small, but like the universe is counting on us. And I'm going to say something circuitous and Brad is probably going to cut it out, but that's okay. So yesterday we saw the William Shatner documentary, Call Me Bill.
I'm keeping this, Lisa. And,
it ends with him going out to space with Bezos and taking a look at the Earth and going like, so fragile, so blue. And he wrote this really beautiful poem, I thought, like a really beautiful poem about like, you know, we're actually just a speck of dust. You know what I mean? And the universe doesn't actually care about us at all. Like, it's really up to us to care about each other
and this little blue planet
and I think about these animals going like, we are limited and yet we're still going to do a thing. I don't know what my question is, but my question is like, I feel like YA is where people have the permission to be a little bit more moral forward, like message forward. Is that part of what is scary? Like, where I feel like with adult stuff, it's just like being ambiguous is like, ooh, I'm nuanced. Where like, you know, like where with
nihilism, how great. Like,
that's very sexy. You know, it's just like nihilism and boobs. That's what we like. You know, is it perilous to be moralistic?
I think, you know what, for me, I don't know if I necessarily think it is moralistic as much as it's something a friend of mine, when he read the issue, said, like, he loved the sincerity of it.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, the characters are so sincere because they are so simple. And so when I think it's things like nihilism and boobs, there's a lack of sincerity there. And so the idea of writing a book where the characters are so inherently sincere, I think that's where the vulnerability sort of comes in, because there are no boobs to hide behind. There's no nihilism to hide behind.
The insincerity of boobs.
The insincerity of boobs.
I tell you, if you see my boobs, I'm being absolutely earnest.
Good to know. But I think that's a little bit of where. Yeah. No, go ahead.
I think based on what you said, you're gonna like the rest of the series. Like, you know, like if all those ideas, like I feel tie into what comes through in the upcoming issues.
I feel like being sincere is like so punk rock right now. I feel like that's like, right now I'm wearing a shirt that says soft as hell.
Nice. Oh, I love that.
Like, I am so utterly sincere, and I really do think it's countercultural to just be vulnerable.
I hope that's true. I really want that to be true. I do think, I would love to think that, like, just with how cynical the culture is, there's like a movement now to just be more sincere. Like, I think that's awesome.
Well, it starts right here.
I don't like it. I don't want there to be a movement to be more sincere. Because then you're
keeping it arms like
sincerely sincere. Like, it just is going to eat itself, and all of a sudden sincerity is a new form of.
But there'll be a small moment where it'll be good. I'm really a jerk.
It's like, it's like, hey, I'm just an asshole. I mean it, man. And I'm like, don't be an asshole. Be insincere and be polite.
It's a 3 month before everyone discovers a restaurant where it'll be awesome. And then there'll be the 3 years after that will be horrible. But those 3 months will be great.
Oh, that would be nice. I guess those 3 months would be good.
You know, a few months can mean a lot. I think as we've all learned recently. Gentlemen, thank you so much for coming on and talking Man's Best. We enjoyed the heck out of the first issue, and we knew we were going to, because we're such big fans of your previous work. And I just didn't know I needed the two of you to collaborate as much as I did until this issue.
Explicit. We're like match made in heaven, beside ourselves with joy.
Yeah. So thank
honestly,
you.
I am thank so you. Grateful I can keep up with Jesse. I was such a huge fan of Jesse going into this. So I'm just happy to keep up.
It's been good. It's nice to have, you know, conversations about themes and morals and stuff as opposed to just layout, which is what I get normally.
I don't know. I think I'm going to be talking word count a lot more. So much math.
As well you should. There's not enough people are talking about the math in comics.
It baffles me every time.
That's true.
Yeah. Well, let's get to our homework, Lisa, and let these two off to create. And there you have it, our conversation with Porn Sack Picture Show and Jesse Lonergan talking about Man's Best number one, currently available from Boom Studios.
We had so much fun with this interview. And like, it left me like buzzing all day. But I felt a little vulnerable at the beginning of that interview because there is this phenomenon. I don't know if it's just me, but like, I read the story and I go like, clearly we're all on the same page with this thing. And then you get into the conversation and you're like, oh, we're not on the same page. So the pace that I'm talking about is like through my experience through animal TikToks and dogs with buttons is I go like, okay, animals are people too. And we all agree on that, right? And they're immediately like, no, it's totally a metaphor and not literally true. And then I'm like, oh no, I just revealed that I, you know, I believe in fairy tales.
Well, what I liked about the conversation was how Pornsack and Jesse weren't necessarily on the same page either. Mm. And they had to work out in this conversation their perspective on the animal protagonists.
Yeah.
What complicates matters, though, regarding like putting ourselves in the position of Athos, Porthos, and Lovey is that they are emotional support animals. And, you know, we're not emotional support animals, right? Like, that caste system doesn't really exist with humanity, although there are caste systems within humanity.
But for me, what makes the animals us is a lot of times when we're trying to help, we don't actually completely understand what the other party needs. Mm-hmm, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And in this story, it's because they don't speak the same language. But like to me, I feel like sometimes I'm trying to help, but I'm not actually listening to what the person actually needs.
Yeah, I know that, Lisa. We podcast together. you know, but what's interesting about that to me is that a conversation about relatability or empathy? Because you can relate to characters that are not clearly you.
Right. Yeah, that's true.
Of course, it's hard to discuss what function these three protagonists serve when we don't have the entire story in front of us. I think we're playing a little bit of a guessing game until we've read the entire tale.
Another little sub-conversation that I've been thinking a lot about is the inherent math that goes into creating a comic. Because I bring it up in this interview. I also bring it up with Becky Cloonan and Tula Lote talking Somna. But like, to me, in my imagination, I'm like, true creativity is being able to do exactly the number of panels the comic needs and exactly the number of pages and whatever number of words that are required. And so I keep asking the question, like, do you feel confined by like a comic book can only be so many pages? And the answer has universally been like, no. In fact, with Pornsack, he's going like, I'm adding even more math and I'm loving it the whole time.
I love the way that they make Man's Best.
Yes.
This idea that Pornsack is like, okay, my scripts are always going to be 5 panels and it's going to be 250 words. And then I give that to Jesse and Jesse's going to do whatever with it.
Yeah.
And when you look at the comic and you go, all right, this page was given to Jesse as 5 panels and then he made 24 panels. Mm-hmm. There is some real magic happening with Man's Best.
Yeah. But like, to me, it shows the bias of my own perspective. Sure. Where I go like, your brain is like my brain, right? And people are like, no, I'm my own person. I was like, and I'm always like, really?
Lisa, we've been doing this for 5 years.
Yeah.
And you're just learning that.
I've learned nothing.
You're a unique creature.
I'm not here to learn lessons. I'm an Enneagram 4, and I'm here to learn about myself.
But we had a great time chatting this comic with Pornsack and Jesse. this is another series where I would like to have another conversation with them once it's all wrapped up.
Yes, please. Yeah.
And if this is your first time approaching either of these creators, you need to go back into their catalog and read everything that they do. I recommend all of it. Lisa and I have read all of it, and it's all gold.
Yes, we're into it. So, and you should be too.
Yes. So next week on the podcast, our friend Daniel Warren Johnson will return. He has recently wrapped up the first arc of his Transformers series, and issue 7 hits shops this Wednesday. Make sure you pick that up. It will be a full spoilers conversation. And the episode after that will be our next Schema counseling session. We're talking Scott Summers and Emma Frost as seen through the lens of Avengers versus X-Men. We want to make sure that we get that episode out before we hit up C2E2 in Chicago.
And hey, if you're at C2E2, be sure to come to our next CBCC panel on Friday at 3:45 in room S405-B.
Before C2E2, though, on April 21st, Lisa and I will be screening Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles 2, The Secret of the Ooze at the Alamo Drafthouse in Winchester, Virginia at 4 o'clock, and we will have a special virtual introduction. Do I go ahead and say it? We haven't gotten the video yet, but I think we need to say it now and sell more tickets. It's Paige Turco. April O'Neil herself from Ninja Turtles 2 and 3 will be providing a virtual introduction.
How fun is that?
Super cool. And if you're a patron, you not only get into Ninja Turtles 2 for free, but you'll see that virtual introduction pop up in the feed this week. And yeah. Batman, 1989's Batman, the 35th anniversary is happening in June, but we're showing that movie in May.
Okay, Brad, we gotta get out of here. And I know that I'm just an emotional support wife, but I'm pretty sure I can fly this spaceship. Where can our listeners send their words of affirmation to you? Did you not like that?
No, I like emotional it. No, support you, wife? You're not an emotional support wife.
I'm a person in my own right.
I'm definitely an emotional support husband, though.
Oh, sometimes. All right,
if we can both be emotional support spouses.
Sometimes when I'm overwhelmed, he just lies on top of me and reminds me to be still.
You can find me on most social medias at MouthDork. If you have words of affirmation for our logo, you can send them to Aaron Prescott at A Cool Hand Fluke. And if you have some words of affirmation for our radical banner art and show posters, send them to Karen Chapp at Karen_X-Men Fan. Lisa, where can our listeners send their words of affirmation to you?
I'm always accepting words of affirmation at Sidewalk Siren on Instagram and Twitter. And like, sorry, I've got a giggle in the back of my throat because of the idea of my emotional support husband just in the aisles of Target, just laying on top of me. If you'd like to spend more quality time with us, you can subscribe to us on Podbean, Spotify, YouTube, Audible, Apple Podcasts, or whatever app you prefer. We're everywhere. If you'd like to get exclusive, you can join our Patreon, where you'll get more content, including weekly bonus episodes.
If you'd like to reach out and touch us electronically, you can email the podcast, cbccpodcast@gmail.com. You can visit our website, comicbookcouplescounseling.com, or follow us on all the socials at cbccpodcast.
You can give us the gift of 5 stars on Audible or Apple Podcasts. And if you'd like to do an act of service, why not write a review of the show while you're there?
Yes, please.
We are fluent and receptive in all 5 love languages. It really warms our hearts and helps the pod.
So until next time, friends, keep your love tank full.
And your psychic rapport open. Doopie doopie. Bum bum ba da bum bum ba da ba. You got me when I was doing my jaw stretches. Gotta stretch that jaw.
Gross.
Well, imagine how it sounds in my ears. Just pops and crackles.